Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today, we open our show with some national news stories from Public News Service, including the latest controversies on Donald Trump's efforts to fill the Attorney General position, a warning from Trump's border czar regarding efforts at mass deportation, and legislation moving through Congress that could make it easier to revoke organizations' nonprofit status as Trump takes office. Then, we'll have a special report from East County Magazine on Trump's controversial nominees for cabinet chairs and other key positions. Two sexually violent predators have been approved for transient release in our region over the objections of local residents and elected officials, and we'll have details on our show today. El Cajon police are searching for the driver of an SUV that struck and killed a pedestrian in a walker and then fled the scene. Hear why health care cuts to low-income Californians are expected under the Trump administration. El Cajon's city council members were stunned to learn that an old law banned dog walking downtown. Hear what action was just taken by the council on our show today. If you need help with fire insurance, the county has a program to help, and we'll have details. From California News Service, hear about a coalition of nonprofits preparing to stand up to the Trump administration. Then on Destination East County, hear about holiday celebrations coming up across our inland region, including a snow day, holiday tree lightings, train rides with Santa, and more. From Public News Service's Yonder Report, learn about rural health findings, flash flood preparations, and tribal green energy initiatives. Plus, we'll be re-airing our interview with Diana Lindsay, the author of Coast to Cactus, a guide to some great hikes across our region. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I hope the president-elect will now consider nominating someone for attorney general who, by character, experience, and qualifications, can fulfill that role and be confirmed.
Democratic Delaware Senator Chris Coons says there is a high bar to become the nation's top law enforcement official. President-elect Donald Trump is tapping former Florida State Attorney General Pam Bondi to lead the Federal Justice Department now that former Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz is withdrawing his name. Trump's pick to lead the Pentagon, Pete Hegseth, is dismissing reporters' questions about whether he sexually assaulted a woman in 2017.
I have, as far as the media is concerned, I'll keep this very simple. The matter was fully investigated, and I was completely cleared, and that's where I'm going to leave it.
According to a just-released police report, the organizer of a Republican women's forum accused him of physically blocking her from leaving a hotel room, taking her phone, and then sexually assaulting her. Last year, the Fox News host paid her a confidential settlement to end what he calls a baseless lawsuit over consensual sex. Trump's pick to lead the Department of Education, former World Wrestling Entertainment executive Linda McMahon, is also facing allegations. A lawsuit contends she knowingly enabled the sexual exploitation of children by a WWE employee. Tom Homan, Trump's pick for border czar, says they'll use land offered by Texas as a staging area for mass deportations. He says any resistance by local Democratic officials will backfire on the migrants.
Then we'll arrest them, we'll fly them out of the state and detain them outside the state, again, away from their families and their attorneys. That what you want? That's what you get.
The House has passed a bill giving the Treasury Secretary the power to declare any nonprofit a terrorist-supporting organization and rescind its tax-exempt status. Jeff Orderer with 350 Action says Trump's rhetoric about the enemy within makes the bill's passage troubling.
They're trying to consolidate the number of tools in their toolbox so they can move quickly to call some people the enemy within and shut down organizations supporting causes that are fighting corporate power, fighting structural racism.
The co-leaders of the new Department of Government Efficiency say fewer federal regulations will mean fewer federal employees. And former GOP presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy says remote staff unwilling to return to the office full-time will be fired.
We expect certain agencies to be deleted outright. We expect mass reductions in force in areas of the federal government that are bloated. I think people will be surprised by, I think, how quickly we're able to move.
Ramaswamy says President-elect Trump has the authority to stop spending even after it's been authorized by Congress. House Republicans introduced legislation Thursday to eliminate the Department of Education and move its critical programs to other departments. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
President-elect Donald Trump has announced many of his cabinet appointees, which require Senate confirmation, as well as other key positions in his next administration that do not. In an unprecedented action, Trump has demanded that the Senate adjourn and allow him to make recess appointments without Senate confirmation, ignoring the constitutional duty of the Senate to provide advice and consent for cabinet nominees. Trump has also indicated that he will prevent the FBI from conducting background checks on appointees, as has always been done, to protect national security and be sure that no one is subject to blackmail. These actions are drawing bipartisan pushback from Congress, where Republicans will soon control both the House and Senate. Outgoing Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, however, has said each of these nominees needs to come before the Senate and go through the process and be vetted, despite Trump's call to the contrary. Incoming Senate Majority Leader John Thune has said the process won't be easy, but insiders predict that Thune, a McConnell ally, will not abdicate his responsibility to have the Senate hold hearings on those appointments requiring Senate confirmation. Now, as for Trump's call for Congress to adjourn and allow him to make recess appointments, that would require approval by both houses of Congress, and according to an analysis by Time magazine, that's unlikely to happen given opposition by not only Democrats, but some Republicans who have voiced concerns over key appointments. While all nominees are Trump loyalists, some have experience and qualifications suited to the position, but other nominees have sparked bipartisan concerns. His most controversial choice, Matt Gaetz, has withdrawn his name from consideration as Attorney General. Gaetz resigned his seat in Congress days before an ethics committee report was set to be released on an investigation into alleged sex trafficking and bribery, and he reportedly did not have the votes to win confirmation, even from Republicans in the majority. Trump's new Attorney General nominee is Pam Bondi, Florida's Attorney General. She was Trump's lawyer during his first impeachment trial. Critics have raised concerns about her support of false claims that the 2020 election was stolen. Here are details on more of Trump's nominees. Pete Hegseth, Secretary of Defense nominee, is a National Guard officer and Army veteran who served in Afghanistan and Iraq. Hegseth is best known as a Fox News co-host. He holds a Master's of Public Policy degree from Harvard University. But in 2017, he, too, was accused by a woman of raping her at a California golf resort. She reportedly suffered injury but backed off suing Hegseth after he paid for her to stay silent. He was married at the time. Hegseth has admitted making the payment but denied the sexual assault, claiming it was consensual. With sexual assault of women in the military a hot-button issue, criticisms have been raised over having a defense secretary who, like Gaetz, has been accused of sexual assault with serious, credible allegations. Brendan Carr, Trump's pick to chair the Federal Communications Commission, wrote the chapter on FCC reforms for the controversial Project 2025, which called for banning TikTok and for the FCC to rein in big tech companies such as Facebook and Google over perceived censorship of conservative voices. As chairman, critics fear he might support Trump's calls to revoke broadcast licenses of TV and radio stations that have provided critical coverage of Trump and to target media outlets that provide fact-checking. Carr is also an ally of Elon Musk and would be in a position to approve funding for Musk's Starlink satellite internet company. Florida Senator Marco Rubio, Secretary of State nominee, gained foreign policy knowledge as Vice Chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee and a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He is expected to take a hardline stance on China, Iran, and several other nations, potentially deepening tensions between the U.S. and China. Rubio has also called for a negotiated settlement to end the war in Ukraine, though Ukraine has opposed any settlement that calls for it to cede land seized by Russia during the invasion. Robert F. Kennedy, Jr., nominated as Secretary of Health and Human Services, dropped out of the presidential race to endorse Trump. He's an outspoken opponent of vaccines. Far beyond COVID, he has disseminated scientifically debunked false claims that vaccines can cause autism and wants to revisit childhood vaccines that have prevented such diseases as polio, measles, and whooping cough. He has also called for removing fluoride from drinking water, which is added to protect children's teeth from cavities. Kennedy, who has admitted that a brain worm damaged his brain, would be overseeing the National Institute for Health, the Centers for Disease Control, and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, among others. His nomination is strongly opposed by medical groups and public health experts. Dr. Mehmet Oz, nominated to serve as director of Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, is known for his appearances on the Oprah Winfrey Show. He has been criticized for promoting vaccine deniers and bogus COVID cures, as well as hawking dubious supplements through false advertising, which prompted a congressional inquiry. In 2015, 10 doctors wrote a letter urging Columbia University's medical school to fire him, arguing that much of the advice on his TV show has been found to be unsupported by scientific evidence and in some cases contradicted by it. Chris Wright would head the Department of Energy. He's the CEO of a fracking company who has denied that climate change is a threat. He is expected to back Trump's announced plans to roll back America's clean energy policies and promote increased reliance on oil, gas, and nuclear power. Lee Zeldin, nominated as Environmental Protection Agency Administrator, has a 15-year record in Congress of consistently supporting the fossil fuels industry, including offshore drilling and opening oil reserves in Alaska. He has called for increasing energy independence and rolling back regulations as head of the agency that's supposed to protect our environment. South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, Secretary of Homeland Security nominee, would oversee agencies including Customs and Border Protection, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the Secret Service, and the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. Noem has taken a hardline stance on immigration, but lacks any experience in immigration or national security. She drew controversy in her memoir when she wrote of killing her young dog after it killed neighbors' chickens. Sean Duffy, Secretary of Transportation nominee, is a former Wisconsin congressman and Fox News co-host, as well as a former prosecutor, athlete, district attorney, and reality TV personality. He sat on the House Financial Services Committee, but lacks any experience in federal transportation infrastructure. John Ratcliffe, nominee for CIA director, served as director of national intelligence during the first Trump administration. Previously, he was on the House Intelligence and Judiciary Committees and was cybersecurity chairman on the Homeland Security Committee. He reportedly warned White House staffers against following through on efforts to overturn the 2020 election, but he was a defender of Trump in Congress during the first impeachment hearing. He has denied Russian interference in Trump's 2016 election and has called China the most serious threat facing the U.S. Doug Collins, nominated for Secretary of Veterans Affairs, is a former Air Force Reserve chaplain who served in Iraq and later as a congressman from Georgia as ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee. Doug Burgum, Secretary of the Interior nominee, is a former Microsoft executive with ties to the energy sector. He has no background in natural resource management or environmental policy. He is expected to back a pro-business, pro-fossil fuel agenda for America's public lands. Tom Homan, Trump's choice to serve as border czar, was the architect of the controversial and brutal family separation policy as acting ICE director during Trump's first term as president, when thousands of children were lost and many have never been located. A former Border Patrol agent, he would once again oversee deportation policies, this time as Trump has pledged to use the military to round up and deport millions of immigrants. Unlike cabinet secretaries, this position is not subject to Senate confirmation. Besides his cabinet nominees, Trump has appointed several attorneys who have represented him on criminal matters to key posts. These include John Sauer for Solicitor General. Sauer is best known for successfully arguing before the Supreme Court that presidents should have broad immunity for official acts. Todd Blanche, as Deputy Attorney General, is Trump's personal lawyer and was lead attorney in the New York hush money case in which Trump was convicted of felonies. Jay Clayton, named U.S. Attorney for New York Southern District, chaired the Securities and Exchange Commission, but has zero criminal prosecution experience. William Joseph McGinley will serve as White House counsel. He most recently handled election integrity for the Republican National Committee. Other nominees and appointments include Susan Wiles as chief of staff. She was Trump's 2024 campaign manager and longtime Republican strategist who has worked on Ronald Reagan's campaign and Ron DeSantis's Florida gubernatorial campaign. Carolyn Leavitt, White House press secretary at age 27, will be the youngest to hold this role. She was assistant press secretary during Trump's first term. Stephen Miller, deputy chief of staff, was a senior advisor in Trump's first term. He's a hardline anti-immigration advocate who was instrumental in rolling out the zero-tolerance family separation policy. Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, co-heads of a new Department of Government Efficiency, will work outside the government and beyond congressional oversight to, quote, drive large-scale structural reform and create an entrepreneurial approach to government, according to Trump. Billionaire Musk owns Tesla, SpaceX, and X, formerly Twitter, and was a major donor to the Trump campaign. Ramaswamy, who ran against Trump in the primary, made cutting government spending a hallmark of his campaign. Stephen Chung, White House Communications Director, was a spokesman for Trump's 2016 campaign, famously calling opponents snowflakes suffering from Trump derangement syndrome. Steve Witkoff, Special Envoy to the Middle East, is a real estate executive who raised donations for Trump from Jewish donors and supports Trump's strong backing of Israel, including Prime Minister Netanyahu's military actions in Gaza, which the United Nations has now declared to be war crimes and crimes against humanity. Mike Huckabee, nominee for ambassador to Israel, is a Christian evangelist and former Arkansas governor who supports Trump's policies towards Israel and Hamas. Hamas, of course, was also named as committing war crimes and crimes against humanity. Huckabee has said any Palestinian state should be pushed into Egypt or Jordan and opposes a ceasefire with Hamas. And Elise Stefanik, UN ambassador nominee, has been a vocal critic of the United Nations. The New York congressional member has called for a reassessment of U.S. funds for the UN due to the Palestinian Authority's efforts to expel Israel from the General Assembly. Reporting on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Crime Beat report. Two San Diego judges have ordered transient releases to temporary locations for sexually violent predators Alvin Quarles and Merle Wakefield locally. The decisions came after repeated failed attempts at permanent housing for the men. The exact locations where they will be released have not been disclosed yet, although both are slated to wear ankle monitors and be guarded 24/7 by security or law enforcement personnel. Quarles has been dubbed the bolder-than-most rapist for a series of sexual assaults in the 1980s committed at knife point, sometimes with the victim's husband or boyfriend forced to watch. Wakefield has been convicted of rape and lewd acts with a child. Both men served many years in prison and received treatment in a state mental hospital prior to the state authorizing their release. Superior Court Yvonne Campos approved release of Wakefield by Tuesday in a vacant home where SVPs have formerly been housed, or into an RV purchased by Liberty Healthcare, which runs the state's conditional release program for SVPs. Wakefield's location is expected to be determined following a December 19th hearing. Attempts to place each of these offenders in local communities, including Mount Helix, Campo, Poway, Hacumba Hot Springs, and Borrego Springs, have been blocked by judges or withdrawn by the state after overwhelming community opposition, including letters from public officials, including Supervisor Joel Anderson and State Senator Brian Jones. District Attorney Summer Steffen, who has opposed release of Quarles and Wakefield, issued this statement. In both of these cases, it was incumbent upon the Department of State Hospitals and their contractor, Liberty Healthcare, to find suitable housing for sexually violent predators who have been ordered conditionally released, where they can be closely monitored and supervised. They failed, despite the court giving them many chances and time to do so, the DA says, adding, "We will continue to oppose transient releases and will insist that Department of State Hospitals fulfill their duty to find suitable fixed placement." Supervisor Anderson, in a letter to Judge Campos, said that Liberty Healthcare has targeted East County communities as their dumping ground for sexually violent predators. Nearly 70% of those released countywide have been in Anderson's district, with the rest in Jim Desmond's district, both in East County, a fact that Anderson argues is unfair. But, Anderson says, transient release of sexually violent predators without a permanent location is even more concerning than the releases that have already occurred due to fears of recidivism. More than 800 people signed a petition that Anderson circulated opposing the temporary release of Wakefield. Occoquan police are seeking public help to locate an SUV that killed a man with a walker, then fled the scene. The 70-year-old man was struck and killed November 19th, shortly after 6 p.m. According to police, he was jaywalking across Hamisha Boulevard near Point Parkway in Occoquan when he was struck. The pedestrian died at the scene. According to an Occoquan press release, after the crash, the driver of the dark-colored SUV made a U-turn and fled eastbound on Hamisha Boulevard. While fleeing the scene, sparks were observed coming from underneath the dark SUV, and a walker was not found at the scene. The SUV has damage to the windshield and driver's side mirror. Vehicle parts located at the scene of the crash identified the dark-colored SUV as a 2018 to 2024 Chevy Traverse. This is an ongoing investigation, and any witnesses who may have information on the accident are encouraged to contact the California Highway Patrol El Cajon office at 619-219-6900. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
As President-elect Donald Trump announces immigration hardliners as Deputy Chief of Staff and Border Czar this week, groups that support undocumented college students in California are vowing to stand up for people's rights. Golden State colleges serve 83,000 undocumented students, according to the Higher Ed Immigration Portal. Jesse Ryan is president of the Campaign for College Opportunity, which is part of the California Undocumented Higher Education Coalition.
We got a glimpse into some of what might be done in the Project 2025 statements, looking at things like mass deportation, including ending pathways to citizenship.
There is also concern that the Trump administration might pull DACA work authorization from the so-called Dreamers, people brought to the U.S. as children. People can find a map of resources broken down by campus on the website of the California Undocumented Coalition for Higher Education. Ryan says she hopes California's sanctuary state law will deter any immigration raids on college campuses, but there's no guarantee.
The mood is very somber, both with the coalition and with our students and families. Many are feeling fearful and uncertain of what their futures will be.
Governor Gavin Newsom just called a special session of the legislature and established a legal fund to challenge efforts to undo protections for vulnerable populations. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
California could be in for some big cuts to health care for low-income families under a second Trump administration, according to health experts. Policy specialists at the nonprofit KFF Health News say they're bracing for Trump allies in Congress to make major reductions to Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act in order to pay for big tax cuts promised by the president-elect. Larry Levitt with KFF says that would force states to backfill or raise costs.
For the ACA, simply letting enhanced financial aid expire after next year would result in big out-of-pocket premium increases, reduced enrollment, and more people uninsured.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr., President-elect Trump's choice for Health and Human Services Secretary, didn't say much on the campaign trail about funding for Medicaid or the Affordable Care Act, so his positions are unclear. Kennedy has expressed skepticism about vaccines and has said the U.S. should stop putting fluoride in drinking water. Jennifer Cates with KFF says the Centers for Disease Control cannot require states to follow its recommendations on vaccines and fluoridation.
That's up to states and local governments, but CDC can recommend. And if those recommendations are not being made or are being watered down or changed, that sends a message to states, to schools, to parents.
Health advocates are also raising concerns that DACA recipients could lose access to health plans sold on the state marketplaces created under the Affordable Care Act. And changes to so-called public charge rules could make families with mixed immigration status hesitant to use Medicaid benefits. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
It's official. El Cajon is going to the dogs. Members of the El Cajon City Council voiced surprise to learn that a 1997 ordinance prohibited dogs in the downtown Superblock area where popular events are held. So on November 19th, council members voted unanimously to repeal the ban and legalize dog walking downtown. Assistant City Manager Vince DiMaggio explained that the ban was originally approved due to a perception that dogs might pose health hazards and increase maintenance needs. However, none of those concerns have materialized, he said, adding that bringing dogs to public places has since become commonplace, including companion animals as well as service dogs. He noted, "We see dozens of dog walkers daily in Centennial Plaza," adding that technically that's illegal, as is walking dogs in Prescott Promenade and other downtown areas where the public frequently brings dogs on leashes when they dine at outdoor cafes, enjoy outdoor concerts and car shows, or simply exercise their pets along public streets. Two public speakers both supported repealing the outdated law. Karen Anderson noted that the 2021 census found 39% of U.S. households own at least one dog, and Pew Research found that 93% consider pets to be family members. Anderson told the council that she chooses which restaurants and other places to frequent based on which ones allow dogs. Bobby, who did not give his last name, noted that El Cajon's police and fire departments now have their own dogs. He said residents need to be able to walk their dogs legally. Repeal the prohibition on dogs in the downtown superblock area, he urged the council. Councilmember Phil Ortiz gave a thumbs up to ending the prohibition. He said that when Bobby approached him to ask if he knew that dog walking was illegal downtown, his reaction was, "No way." He said allowing dogs would be a great move to enhance the downtown area since they're like family members. He noted that El Cajon is a dog-friendly community that recently sponsored an event at a park to try and break a world record for the most dogs watching the dog-themed movie Beethoven. Councilman Steve Goebel stated, "Most people don't even know this is illegal," and he added, "If we're going to encourage housing that is pet-friendly, then we need to have a place to walk dogs and repeal this ordinance." Goebel asked staff if dogs could be prohibited on a case-by-case basis, such as Haunt Fest, where some dogs get stressed out by large crowds and scary sights and sounds. Staff assured him that this could be done. Councilmember Kerry Kendrick, who owns two dogs of his own, said San Diego neighborhoods such as Kensington are welcoming to dog owners. "I think it would be great to have dogs out there," he said of El Cajon's downtown. And Councilmember Michelle Mitchell said, "I have a house full of animals. I didn't know that it was prohibited. I brought my big dog downtown many times and ate here at the restaurants." The council voted unanimously to repeal the ban on leashed dogs downtown. A second reading of the ordinance will take place in December. Reporting for East County Magazine in El Cajon, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
By a unanimous vote, county supervisors have authorized the San Diego County Fire Authority to provide a dedicated staffer to help homeowners with applications to the Wildfire Prepared Home Program. The program, provided through the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety, offers a discount on insurance premiums to homeowners who apply and meet fire safety requirements. To apply, homeowners must pay an application fee of $125 and pass an inspection. Now, county fire officials can also visit homes to help homeowners assure that they have met the wildfire mitigation requirements. Supervisor Joel Anderson says many constituents have reached out to his office with concerns about fire insurance. As the only supervisor who lives in an unincorporated community, he says, "I know firsthand the challenges homeowners face as we have seen our costs and premiums skyrocket. Working with my colleague Supervisor Jim Desmond and County Fire, we have partnered together to help make a positive impact at the county level," he adds. The Wildfire Prepared Home Program is a do-it-yourself model where homeowners must independently complete the necessary mitigation steps at their home. This can be an overwhelming process, which is why supervisors approve having County Fire's team assist homeowners by offering guidance on regulations, helping with applications, and performing inspections to ensure compliance. The program may not be suitable for everybody, but for those who do qualify, it's a step in the right direction. Those who may benefit most from the program include new residential construction permit holders, participants in the California Wildfire Mitigation Program, or Home Hardening Grant, and homes built after the 2008 Building Code update, which incorporated fire-resistant materials. California is currently facing a home insurance crisis. Many insurers have reduced coverage in wildfire-prone areas, exiting the state entirely, or they have significantly increased premiums, leaving homeowners scrambling to find affordable options. Supervisor Anderson concludes, "While we do not have control over insurance rates at the county level, we can make a meaningful difference by empowering residents to reduce wildfire risks and protect their homes."
This weekend, a new coalition called We Are California is holding meetings up and down the state, preparing to resist anticipated attacks from the incoming Trump administration.
Hundreds of nonprofits have joined the coalition, whose mission is to promote inclusion, community, and democratic norms. Angelica Salas is with CIRLA, the Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights of Los Angeles.
So what are we bracing for? Exactly what Donald Trump said he was going to do. Mass deportations, family separation, worksite raids. These are all things that he has done in the past. But what we're expecting is a scale of attack on our community that is unprecedented.
The coalition hopes that by banding together, they can fight any erosion of civil rights for LGBTQ plus people, immigrants, and more. The gatherings this weekend will take place online and in person in the Bay Area, Fresno, Los Angeles, Orange County, and San Diego. Find out more at wearecalifornia.org. Salas says California has also put limits on how new immigration detention centers can be built.
We can also model what it means to resist, but what it means to defy. Because I think last time we resisted, this time around, it's really about putting in place everything that interrupts this agenda.
In 2017, lawmakers passed the California Values Act, which says no state or local resources can be used to assist federal immigration enforcement and declares schools, hospitals, and courthouses as safe spaces. The California Trust Act says jails should not hold people with low-level nonviolent offenses past their initial detention period solely to give the feds time to initiate deportation proceedings. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for San Diego's inland region. Now, stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
Welcome to East County Magazine's Destination East County, bringing you all of the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County each week.
This is Miriam Raftery with East County Magazine's Destination East County, bringing you all the most fun festivals and events coming up across our inland region. Santee hosts its holiday tree lighting on Friday, November 22nd from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the Santee Trolley Square. This event features sledding, live music, face painting, and photos with Santa. The tree lighting takes place at 6:15 p.m. Find full details at thecityofsantee.gov on their calendar. The famous North Pole Limited returns to celebrate the holiday season Fridays and Saturdays, November 29th through December 21st at the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum's Campo Depot. Trains depart Fridays and Saturdays at 5 p.m. and 7 p.m. Arrive at least 30 minutes early to receive your tickets, explore the holiday gift shop, and soak up a festive atmosphere. Once on board the North Pole Limited train ride, a Jolly Elf crew will entertain you with holiday sing-alongs, festive stories, and delicious hot chocolate and cookies. As the train winds through the backcountry, keep your eyes peeled for the North Pole, where the train will pick up Santa and Mrs. Claus. Santa and Mrs. Claus will visit with every passenger on the train as the 90-minute ride returns to the Campo Depot. For tickets, which do sell out early for the North Pole Limited, you can visit the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum at psrm.org. Julian holds its annual Country Christmas Tree Lighting Celebration on November 30th from 12 noon to 8 p.m. at the Julian Town Square. The event features craft booths, vendors, live music all day, a Christmas market, tree lighting, and Santa Claus meet and greets starting at 6. For details, you can visit the Julian Country Christmas page on Facebook or go to visitjulian.com. You can kick off the holiday season at El Cajon's Holiday Lights on Main, hosted by the Downtown Businesses on Saturday, November 30th from 3 p.m. to 9 p.m., featuring festive fun for the whole family with amusement rides, an ice skating rink, a cookie decorating station, live music, and photos with Santa in the lobby of the Courtyard Marriott. For details, visit downtownelcajon.com. The City of Lemon Grove invites you to the city's annual community bonfire on Friday, December 6th from 4:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Traganza Heritage Park on Main Street. Enjoy visits with Santa, music with a live band, a game truck, crafts, inflatables, free cookies, hot chocolate, and popcorn, more foods available for purchase, welcoming remarks from the mayor, an ugly sweater contest, and more. Even sunny San Diego can get snow with the help of modern technology. You're invited to Snow Day at Lindo Lakes on December 6th from 2 to 5 p.m. as the county turns this popular park into a family-friendly winter wonderland with fresh snow for sledding and snow play. You can also enjoy games, giveaways, and photos with Santa. The event will take place at the ball field at Lindo Lakes in Lakeside. For more information, you can visit sdparks.org. The La Mesa Holiday in the Village is an event open to the community featuring live music, cozy fires, craft vendors, food, holiday photo opportunities, including selfies with Santa, and a kids' area bigger than Santa's toy shop. The festivities take place on Saturday, December 14th from noon to 9 p.m. along La Mesa Boulevard between Spring Street and 4th. Visitors can walk the streets of La Mesa's historic downtown village while exploring dozens of local craft vendor stands and then cozy up with artisan and craft food and snack specialties. Friends and family can relax by the fire pits while enjoying holiday caroling, cheerful holiday music, and live entertainment from local schools, clubs, and more. For full information and a schedule of these events, you can visit lamesavillageassociation.org. That's all for this week. We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions from San Diego's East County.
A new rebate program could save California families up to $8,000 on an electric pump for home heating and cooling. The Home Electrification and Appliance Rebates Program is funded by the Biden administration's Inflation Reduction Act. Dina Carrillo with the California Energy Commission encourages homeowners to replace their older natural gas-powered systems.
More efficient electric heat pumps can lower your energy bills, and they'll also help decarbonize your homes to make sure that the air in your home is cleaner.
Tech data suggests that the median heat pump HVAC install in California costs almost $19,000. Families who make between 80 and 150% of the area median income qualify for a $4,000 rebate, and those who make less than that are eligible for the full $8,000 rebate. Get more information at Tech Clean California's page for the HEE HRA program. The program fights climate change by reducing reliance on natural gas, which is a fossil fuel, to heat homes and run power plants. So, Carrillo says, more electric heat pumps should lower California's carbon emissions.
We need to be looking at using energy more efficiently. That will reduce greenhouse gas emissions, both locally in your home and in our effort to fight climate change nationally.
The state rolled out a program in October that benefits multifamily households. California expects to give out 15,000 rebates for single-family and multifamily households over the life of the program. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
By unanimous vote, county supervisors have authorized the San Diego County Fire Authority to provide a dedicated staffer to help homeowners with applications to the Wildfire Prepared Home Program. The program, provided through the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety, offers a discount on insurance premiums to homeowners who apply and meet fire safety requirements. To apply, homeowners must pay an application fee of $125 and pass an inspection. Now, county fire officials can also visit homes to help homeowners assure that they have met the wildfire mitigation requirements. Supervisor Joel Anderson says many constituents have reached out to his office with concerns about fire insurance. As the only supervisor who lives in an unincorporated community, he says, I know firsthand the challenges homeowners face as we have seen our costs and premiums skyrocket. Working with my colleague Supervisor Jim Desmond and County Fire, we have partnered together to help make a positive impact at the county level, he adds. The Wildfire Prepared Home Program is a do-it-yourself model where homeowners must independently complete the necessary mitigation steps at their home. This can be an overwhelming process, which is why supervisors approve having County Fire's team assist homeowners by offering guidance on regulations, helping with applications, and performing inspections to ensure compliance. The program may not be suitable for everybody, but for those who do qualify, it's a step in the right direction. Those who may benefit most from the program include new residential construction permit holders, participants in the California Wildfire Mitigation Program, or Home Hardening Grant, and homes built after the 2008 Building Code update, which incorporated fire-resistant materials. California is currently facing a home insurance crisis. Many insurers have reduced coverage in wildfire-prone areas, exiting the state entirely, or they have significantly increased premiums, leaving homeowners scrambling to find affordable options. Supervisor Anderson concludes, while we do not have control over insurance rates at the county level, we can make a meaningful difference by empowering residents to reduce wildfire risks and protect their homes.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, this is the news from rural America. Obesity, chronic illness, and substance abuse rates are higher in rural America, where 20% of the population lives and works. But researchers say their public health is underfunded and understudied. A new plan from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention aims to address that disparity. Alan Morgan is with the National Rural Health Association.
It shows the commitment of CDC towards rural communities and their willingness to make sure rural communities are as adequately prepared as urban communities.
To create the plan, the CDC reviewed more than 200 rural health initiatives. Morgan says the blueprint's designed to strengthen the rural public health structure and its workforce by collaborating with local hospitals and agencies.
They have highlighted longstanding issues, and now they have a plan to get to where they need to be.
Flash floods, like the torrential rains that came with Hurricane Helene, can devastate rural communities. Julia Tilton says new research aims to better prepare local folks.
2 years ago, flash floods in eastern Kentucky killed 45 and caused millions in damage. Now, a nearly $80 million investment by the National Science Foundation is helping researchers in Appalachia use new data to look for ways to help. For instance, lead investigator Dr. Kenton Senna says they want to know which causes more damage, storms that last days or a short, intense rainfall.
What if we have a 2-inch rain event in 3 hours? What kinds of flood risk are we looking at? That helps us to build out the predictive framework.
Senna says the watershed data could help save lives through an early warning system that's better tailored to the local situation.
Because obviously the watershed will respond differently in those different scenarios with respect to flooding.
I'm Julia Tilton.
Native American tribes are looking to play a key role in the nation's energy future. President-elect Donald Trump has promised U.S. energy dominance, meaning more fossil fuels. But lower-cost renewables are moving the market towards clean energy. And Daniel Cardenas with the National Tribal Energy Association is hopeful that market reality will encourage the next administration to stay flexible.
They weren't outright anti-renewable. I think that's probably the route that things will go.
A vast majority of mineral deposits needed for energy transition are within 35 miles of tribal nations' reservations. Cardenas says that means they should be key partners in decision-making.
Collectively, tribes are the largest private landowners in the United States outside the federal government. So no matter what, if the country needs and wants to develop more infrastructure, the path to that is through Indian country.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown. For more rural stories, visit dailyyonder.com.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Next up, we'll be re-airing one of our Best of East County episodes, our interview with Diana Lindsay, the author of Coast to Cactus.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Diana Lindsay. My guest is president of Sunbelt Publications and leading editor of the book Coast to Cactus, The Canyoneer Trail Guide to San Diego Outdoors. Coast to Cactus, which was published by Sunbelt in partnership with the San Diego Natural History Museum, contains 245 outings and 73 extension hikes. Welcome, Diana. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
Let's start with the book. I know that it's based on the weekly Romo-Rama column for the San Diego Reader, and it's the field guide to the Natural History Museum's exhibition, Coast to Cactus, Southern California. But summarize, if you will, what readers will find in Coast to Cactus that they may not find elsewhere. How is it unique?
Well, first of all, it's more than a hiking guide. It is also a field guide. So unlike having to take your hiking guide out into an area that you want to explore along with many trail guides for flowers, for birds, for amphibians or reptiles, you can just take this one book, because what it does do is function as a field guide. There's 525 different species that are found in San Diego County that are featured, that have photos in them, that have full descriptions. So this is just the one book that you need to be able to study and learn about the county as you're hiking on a trail.
So that makes it much more practical.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's such a wonderfully colorful book.
Yeah, it has 665 color photos in it. It has 258 maps. It also features the habitats that you will find within the county. We're using the system that San Diego State University has on 9 different habitats that are found in San Diego County. And each of the maps has a symbol by it telling you what habitat you will encounter on that hike. So in some hikes, for instance, you may just have a chaparral or a riparian area. So there'll be the symbols for those two habitats next to the map, and you'll know you will encounter that on the hike. But another hike may have 5 or 6 different types of habitats that you will encounter as you are on the trail. So we're trying to teach people to become aware of when they hike, you know, what types of habitats they actually will encounter on those hikes.
That's wonderful. And can you also explain the map in the beginning of the book with the chapters for depending on which region?
We have a map in the front of the book, and we decided not to use a grid system that many hiking books do use. We wanted to make it easier for the readers so we have broken up the chapters according to logical areas that are geographical boundaries by freeways. So you can look at an area that's encompassed by, let's say, Interstate 15 or 5 and cross freeways that go, and you can go into that chapter and you will find all the hikes that are within that area. We have the overall breakdown of the book broken into the coastal hikes, the inland hikes, which are the foothills. We have the mountain hikes and the desert hikes. So those are the 4 regions that we cover within the book. And then within each of those regions, we break it down into geographical areas to make it easier for people to find those particular places that they want to explore.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So much to discover.
Yes.
Now, I understand that your company envisioned a hiking guide to the county, but then Jerry Schad's A Foot in a Field was published by Wilderness Press in 1986. How did that desire lead you to the production of Costa Cactus?
Well, my husband and I wrote the guidebook for the Anzabrego Desert region in 1978, and then we had thought beyond that, thinking that what was really needed was a guide to the entire county. Meanwhile, Jerry had been working on the county guide, and he came out with his book. It's a very excellent book. And so that kind of put our desires to do a county book on a shelf, but always we had that in the back of our minds. You know, if we were going to do a book, how could we do it that would be different than what Jerry did that people would be interested in? And at the time, you know, we wanted to learn more about the county and the things that we could see on the trail. And that's when we joined the San Diego Natural History Museum and became canyoneers almost 30 years ago. And to learn about the species and the plants and the habitats that are found on trails. And from that experience, the idea evolved that, well, what if we took this experiences of knowing the species and the habitats and actually integrated it within a guidebook, would that be something that people would be interested in? And would it actually lead to really learning about the county and helping to understand what is actually found in our county?
How long did it take to put this together? It sounds like an enormous project.
Well, we introduced I introduced the idea of working on a book such as this about a decade ago, and it seemed like an overwhelming project. So it kind of sat on a back shelf for many, many years. And actually what happened, Jerry unfortunately had passed away, and I was at his memorial service, and the publisher of the San Diego Reader, Jim Holman, had said that they were looking for somebody to take over the Roma Rama column, which Jerry had written very wonderful columns throughout the years.
Right.
So I went back to the Canyoneers and I said, you know, we have an opportunity here to actually do this book, and it would be more manageable because all we would have to do is do one article a week until we had enough articles to put it together in a book. And so that's when we made an agreement with my publishing house, the San Diego Natural History Museum, and the Canyoneers to work on this, and then we began the columns, a weekly column for the San Diego Reader. After several years, we had enough to do a book, and then the real work began. So then it was about 18 months, 2 years, to then basically strip all of the descriptions, pull it back, check all the descriptions for the trails to make sure they're accurate, and then to reinsert the descriptions, but not repeating them, only doing one particular detailed description in the book for every species that we wanted to cover. The difficulty here was to make sure that when we did put a species description in, that it was actually found on that trail and that the description was accurate. So we had to have all the curators with their specialties check everything we wrote. We had to work with all of the agencies where the trails were found and then run the trail descriptions by them to make sure they were accurate. They checked our trails. And so we made sure that not only were the species descriptions correct, that the habitats mm-hmm. that we said were there were correct, but that all of the information regarding those species were correct. And then, and so that was a long project. Yeah, we had two other editors besides myself that worked very closely together. So we made sure that all the descriptions were accurate, and then we went back and forth and double-checked everything.
It really sounds like a labor of love.
Well, actually, it was a labor of love because unlike most books where an author has the royalty and they make money from this book, everybody that worked on this book, all the canyoneers, and there's over 50 people who made contributions to the Roma-Rama articles that we used, and the editors, myself and Paula Noel and Terry Barnell, all of us are volunteers at the San Diego Natural History Museum. So all our work was as a volunteer for the museum, and all the proceeds from the book that a normal author would receive are going to the museum. So when anybody buys Wonderful. This book, they're actually supporting the San Diego Natural History Museum.
That's nice to know. Talk a little bit more about the Canyoneers and this exhibit at the museum.
Yes, the Canyoneers are it's a program at the museum that's over 40 years old, and it was started by a botanist, Helen Shamley, at the museum. There was a canyon next to the museum, still there, mm-hmm. a Florida canyon, which was very lovely canyon. In several years later, after the Canyoneers began, it actually, there was a fire there, and that's what resulted in the Canyoneers actually moving out into the county. But the original idea was to have docents that were trained by the museum curators to take the public into the Florida Canyon. They were called the Florida Canyoneers, and to teach people what was in there and the value of that particular habitat. After the fire occurred, the habitat was not as pristine as it once was, so that's when the Canyoneers began to expand to do walks throughout the whole county, which we do now. We do offer free public walks every single weekend, and that is between September and June. You can find the free public walks by going onto the website for the San Diego Natural History Museum or picking up a brochure. No reservations required. Just show up. We break up into small groups, and the whole idea of a canyoneer walk is not to hurry up to get there and hurry up to get back. It's to walk slowly, to look around, to investigate, to smell, to see right. what the interaction is in the habitat with the surrounding plants and species.
So to engage all your senses.
Absolutely. And you asked about the connection to the exhibition, the Costa Cactus Southern California. That exhibition was created to basically get the county and the folks in the county to be aware of the habitats that are found here in the county. But more important than that, to understand that San Diego is a biological hot zone. It's a biodiversity hot zone. There are 32 places in the world that are hotspots, and to be a hotspot means that you have incredible diversity in an area, but you have threatened species or species that have disappeared. And because of that, you want to keep an eye and watch these areas very carefully. And because San Diego is a hotspot, we want people to be aware of what is out here. We want them to become more conscious of conservation for this area. And so that was part of what the exhibit is all about. So you can go to the exhibit, you can learn about the habitats, learn why San Diego is a hotspot, and then you can take the field guide, which is actually a complement to this exhibition, and this is your field guide to get into the field to actually see what's out there. So it complements the exhibition. One mm-hmm. is an actual museum experience, the other one is a field experience.
And do you think this will help conservation efforts?
We certainly hope so. It's, you know, the museum and also my publication house believe very strongly in what a Senegalese conservationist, Baba Douim, has said. And what he has said is, in the end, We will conserve only what we love. We will love only what we understand. And we will understand only what we are taught. And so that's what the exhibition is about. That's what this book is about. It's about teaching folks in San Diego County what is special about this county. And once you learn and get excited about it, you're going to have a personal feeling for it, and you're going to want to protect it and lead to taking care of these special areas, which as our county grows and more people move into it, we want to make sure these particular areas are protected.
Wonderful. I can't wait to dig into this book. One last question. What is your favorite trail?
Well, I'm known as a desert person, so obviously my favorite trails are all in the Anza-Brego Desert State Park area. And those trails kind of vary for me depending on my moods. If I want a kind of a closed-in experience, I like to go into the slot canyons. Those are kind of fun because they're magical, especially with the light changes. If I want to have spectacular views, I might want to go up on Whale Peak and kind of take a look at the views around there. Split Mountain is always great for geology. Coyote Canyon is wonderful because it has the longest running stream in San Diego County. It always has water. Mountain Palm Canyon is wonderful. Mountain Palm Springs, rather. It has just wonderful palm trees that are in there. And then plus if you go up to Torote Bowl, there's the very rare elephant tree and the spectacular view of the Vallecito Badlands. So there's many special places in the Anza-Brego Desert. Fonts Point, a lot of people like to go out there and take a look at that spectacular view, especially at sunset, as you look out over the Borrego Badlands. But it's a very special place. So for me, I'm happy almost anywhere in the desert.
And have you always been a desert person?
Well, not really. It's interesting that you should ask that because this happens to be my 50th anniversary of my introduction to Anza-Brego State Park. I had actually met my husband at a mountaineering club at UCLA when we always went backpacking the Sierras. And when he became a helicopter pilot with the Navy, we were stationed in San Diego, and he would fly over the desert on training missions and said, "Hey, we need to go out and check out that place." And I said, "Come on, get real. This is a desert. There's nothing there. That's right. Why it's a desert." And so we had a few arguments back and forth because he would say, "Come on, we really need to check it out." And I finally said, "Look, if I go one time out there, would you just quit bugging me?" So we went. I had a fantastic experience. It was spring. It was Painted Gorge out on Coyote Mountains. The following week, he said, "Okay, let's go to the Sierras." And I said, "Can we go back to the desert?" And I've been going ever since. My master's thesis was done on it, and several books have been done on the desert. And I always am anxious to get back to the desert.
Well, thank you for sharing your story.
You're welcome.
Our time is up, but it's been wonderful talking to you, Diana.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me.
For more information on Coast to Cactus, please visit sunbeltpublications.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, A.K. Jewell, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.